everyone. Welcome back to Success Made to Last. I'm Rick Tokeny. This is our 40 at 40 leadership show, where we have a special selection of leaders bringing out the best version of themselves, their network, and their companies. And today we're so pleased to have on William Barnes, who is the co-founder of Moving Capital. William, welcome to our show.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. And share a little bit about your career journey.
My career journey. Well, I studied mechanical engineering at university. After that, I had a sales job, like a managed IT company in London. After that, I started what I think the people now call a direct-to-consumer company, but back then was called an e-commerce company. We had a warehouse, and we made stuff and sold it over the internet, as was the fashion. And we also had an online publishing business, a blog network. We hired a large army of kind of writers and sold advertising against it, and kind of had several verticals. I sold both of those, probably be late 2000s, I think, around 2010 or 11, mm-hmm. We sold those. And then through that, I got to meet Travis Kalanick, and that's when I joined Uber. We were probably about 50 people at the time, and this was end of 2011, beginning of 2012, and came on board to launch Los Angeles, and over the next 6 years kind of grew with the company. And by the time I left, I was running the West Coast of the US. And I came out of there and started angel investing in former colleagues' companies and investing alongside some other former Uber alumni. And over the last couple of years, that has evolved into an Uber alumni investing syndicate. And we kind of do that investing under the banner called Moving Capital.
Fantastic. You probably have a lot of war stories from Uber, and I won't get into that today, but how about sharing a little bit of advice to individuals that are considering going into disruptive companies on what should they be looking at in terms of company culture and some other nuances when they enter into a company that may be as fast and fluid as Uber?
Well, I think that depends on, you know, the stage they are in their career and, you know, kind of what success looks like for them. I think the younger that you are, I think the bigger risk that you can take, the fewer people that you have either depending on you, or, you know, kind of the more shocks to the system that you can take from, you know, kind of business ventures that don't work out. I think would mean that, you know, in your early 20s, or throughout your whole 20s, you should be taking as big a risk as possible. So, you know, I think you are more geographically flexible, and I think you're less tied down to job titles or cash flow needs. So you can take more equity risk. So I think the advice I would give someone who's starting out in their career is to go and find macro trends, you know, like what do we think is going to be true over the next 5 years? You know, like, you know, remote working is a thing, autonomous hardware is a thing, you know, kind of artificial intelligence is a thing. You've got these big macro trends, and I would think about interesting companies in that space. And then I would, you know, encourage people to move across the world, across the country, to go and get inside companies doing interesting things over in that space. Because that information and the industry experience that you gather will compound over the, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years that you work in there, and the rest of the kind of the economic market will reward you and find that information more valuable as that macro trend also becomes true for the broader economy.
Very insightful. I happen to know that you have had many mentors in your life. Can you just tell us about one of your favorite mentors and what they've meant to you?
Favorite mentors? I think this is an interesting, I mean, you know, I'm English, and, you know, I've lived in America since my mid-20s, and I found the idea of mentorship and mentees, et cetera, it was a much more an American idea than one in the UK. And so I was already a I was already an adult by the time I was introduced to it. And one of the things I was encouraged to do as, you know, my younger years is you can look around and find different pieces of different people, both fictional and real, to inspire you and give you advice for different things that you're trying to achieve in your life. You know, whether that's artistic or financial or ethical. And I think having a broader lens with which to learn from people is what advice I give other people is, you know, not putting all that responsibility on one person to mentor you about, you know, all facets of life. Mm-hmm. I think this kind of opens you up. You know, for me, prior to, you know, obviously Travis Kalanick, the founder of Uber, I feel like taught me and a lot of people a great deal of things about business. He's an incredible operator. You know, I think Uber was a great boot camp for future CEOs. I mean, the amount of responsibility and the amount of complexity in the business that we were given a lot of responsibility to manage. But I also found successful football managers, people like Alex Ferguson or Arsene Wenger, who were both prominent when I was younger than I am now. There's a lot of lessons to be learned there about, you know, how you manage interpersonal dynamics and groups of people and create a high performance culture, and how do you recruit people and how do you deal with conflict and messaging to the press. And yeah, and so, you know, I find sports a good metaphor for business. And so I was inspired by a large variety of people, and I would cherry pick certain bits of their personality or their story to help me deal with whatever I was facing in a professional capacity.
Yeah, that makes sense. Thanks for that insight. That is what part of the reason why we're doing this 40 at 40, because we're trying to find out, you know, what makes people tick and how they think. And to the this point about mentoring, I have personally witnessed you mentoring individuals. And I happen to know that there is a William Barnes tribe that exists in this world, a bunch of guys that come to you and ask you questions. Kind of flipping this around, what has mentoring meant to you? And specifically, if I were to talk to one of your proteges today, what would you say that their relationship with you has meant?
That's very kind of you to say. I don't know if that's true, but I appreciate that. I think someone much smarter than me said that, you know, giving advice is a form of nostalgia, allowing someone to access memories and relive past glories.
I hope that's not true.
I think there's some truth in that. You know, kind of regaling people with war stories, you know, from past victories. You know, I don't know. It's an interesting question. What would some of the people I used to work with, what would they say? I mean, I can tell you what I hope they would say.
Okay.
What I would hope they would say is that, you know, I've given them some confidence, you know, to tackle a problem, you know, full on, or to take a swing at something, or, you know, kind of see a professional choice as a, you know, you're playing a game in a way, and there's more important things in life, you know, when it comes to family or friends or, you know, your personal ethics. And from a professional perspective, you know, kind of to treat it as a fun game. And so I would hope that, you know, I've been a trusted sounding board for someone and help them kind of bring out the answers from within them rather than telling them what to do. And instill them with some confidence.
Of course. And you actually answered the other part of the question in how you answered that, because I can tell that you actually enjoy the art of mentoring. True?
Yes, I guess. I mean, I don't think I've ever thought about it in that sense. But yes, I mean, I think being a good boss or being a good friend or husband or son is being, you know, being available for someone and trying to think about the thing or the topic or the, you know, kind of the thing we're talking about from their perspective and helping them through a series of questions. And, you know, I think in America, that's called mentoring.
That is right. That's right. And one of the reasons why we wanted to talk to William today is specifically about startups and funding. And we know that you read or write deal memos every day. Underneath all that MBA BS talk and math as a narrative, what do you think makes a compelling deal memo?
A compelling deal memo or a compelling deal?
I'll let you take it as the compelling deal. How about that?
So a compelling deal, I mean, I could talk about this for a long time. I mean, there are general, you know, there's an idiom that says that in the pre-seed stage, you're betting on the founder. On the seed stage, you're betting on the team. On a Series A investment, you're betting on attraction. Series B, you're betting on revenue. And a Series C, you're betting on the unit economics working. You know, and I think within that, you know, there's certain things that I personally look for. So, you know, when you're interacting with a founder, yeah, you got to, I'm asking myself the question, can this person running the company and working for them, like work with this person? And can I see other credible people? Can this founder sell other investors to give them money? Because if I'm going to invest, you know, for the company to be successful, this, you know, the founder's going to have to convince other people to invest.
Right.
You know, and can the founder sell customers to give them money? So how good is this founder at selling everybody around them? Like, come join the company, give the company money, get customers to give them money for their product. Yeah, and then there's slightly more intellectual things for, you know, do I think this team has unfair insights about the, you know, the market they're dealing with, or do they have unfair knowledge through industry experience, or, you know, they've worked in the industry before, or they're coming at it from completely fresh eyes, you know, either because it's the first time they've looked at the market, or they're young, or whatever. Mm-hmm. Do I think there's a clear path to revenue? I also think it's important that your distribution channels are defensible, or you can own them, like you can own the customer relationship. And I also like startups or companies that are attacking a very large market with broader macro trends. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the market forces can drag a business along. You know, there's an inevitability about it. And the last thing as well that I try and ask myself as well is, are the incumbents disincentivized to compete? You know, is there something structurally true about an incumbent business which will make it hard for them to compete with a new entrant?
Boy, those are...
So they're kind of the broad things I look for.
Yeah, that is great insight and wisdom. That's what we were seeking today, especially on that topic of unfair insights and fresh eyes and defensibility of the distribution channels. That makes total sense. We've got just a couple more questions with William today. And to the entrepreneurs that are listening to this show, tell them why it's important to test value propositions and experience fast failure before doing an official launch.
Well, I think that question is probably aimed at early stage entrepreneurs like pre-seed or seed stage companies.
That's correct.
I think it's important. Because every, you know, as a great philosopher once said, everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think it's very easy to get wrapped up in the academics or the intellectual hypothetical of what could be true, or we're going to do this and we're going to do that. And I think just go and get one customer who's going to pay you. And by doing that, there's so many things that have to become true. And there's so many things, so many of your assumptions that get tested. And I also see early stage founders also not charging for a product yet. And I also think that's a bad idea. I think you've got to start charging as soon as possible, because otherwise you don't know how much people value something. And so the sooner you can get one person paying for your product, the sooner a whole bunch of assumptions get tested, the sooner you are forced to engage in a bunch of other tough decisions around branding and technical stack and all these types of things. And the sooner you start collecting data and you're able to interview people and understand what you can do more of or less of for somebody to fall in love with your product. I mean, I think someone smarter than me said it's better to have 1,000 people who love you than a million people that kind of like you.
Oh, that is so true. That's beautifully stated. Okay, so I had the chance one time to talk with Peter Drucker and his family, and Peter Drucker said lots of great things in his lifetime, and one was that culture eats strategy for breakfast. And if you believe that, what advice would you give to startups about building the right team and strategy, especially to kind of build out this wonderful culture from day one, not in the thousandth day of the company, but building the right culture and right team from day one?
Yeah, I mean, you're going to build a culture whether you like it or not. That you don't really have a choice about that. Mm-hmm. You know, I've always defined culture as what does your team do in the absence of explicit direction? You know, what behaviors do they take when you're not in the room?
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to happen organically whether you like it or not. And I think the mental model that I encourage early stage founders to think about is that people are going to notice and copy what you do much more than what you say. And so all the decisions you make about what office you're going to work out of, whether you're available over the weekend, the tone you take with your customers and your vendors, what you wear to the office, how you decide about the lunch policy, all of these things are small little data points that your team uses to extrapolate what the tribe and the culture of the company is going to be. And if you're not careful, at some point in the future, you'll come in and you realize that you may or may not like the culture of the company that you now work at, even as a founder. And so I would encourage the founders from an early stage to use some of these big decisions. Well, not big decisions, but I would use some of these decisions, whether it's, you know, your lunch policy or the office or how you negotiate with vendors, as an opportunity to explain the principles that you use to make these decisions to your team. Now, why is that helpful? Well, first of all, if you have to externalize the principles you use to make a decision, if you have to communicate them to somebody else, it means you're going to have to think about it deeply, which means you're going to take a pause before you make a big decision, because you're like, well, I have to explain this to other people. So you're going to have to think it through and articulate it. And that means that the people in your team and the rest of the company are going to have some of the ambiguity removed, and they're going to be able to understand the principles that you use. And they're more likely to be able to replicate that when they go and make decisions without you, which also in turn allowed you to scale faster because you don't have to be involved in quite as many decisions as you would do otherwise.
So the big test is when the leader is absent from the room, how people are actually behaving and acting.
Well, that is your culture.
That is. That's true. That's the first litmus test, I would say.
Yeah.
Hey, that's great wisdom. Okay, final question for you. You know that you are always coaching me on the sideline about podcasting. So what question would you like for me to ask the other 39 people that are part of the 40 at 40 group?
That's a good question. What would your 20-year-old self think about how you spend your time today?
Oh, I like that. What would your 20-year-old self think about how you spend your time today?
Yeah. Okay. Or maybe more actionable for your listeners would be, what advice would you give your 20-year-old self?
Okay. Yeah. We've used that as one of the signature questions per your suggestion in the past, and it's always brought out some interesting. What's the answer? What's your answer to that question?
Take more risk.
Oh, I love that. That fits you well. Well, listen, hey, thank you for
Sorry, yeah, go on.
I was going to say
compared to a lot of my friends at university that are now lawyers and doctors, I think they may balk at that. But, you know, you look back and, you know, it's hard to convince a 20-year-old, like, how many swings of the bat you're going to get between 20 and 40. And the more swings and the faster you take the swings, the higher chance there is you're going to knock one out of the park.
That's exactly right. Hey, William, thanks for being on our show today. You are a man of wisdom, and we want to have you back on again. And thanks for being a part of this Success Made to Last program, and congratulations on making the 40 top leaders.
Thank you very much.
You bet. That was William Barnes. We thank him for being on our Success Made to Last show today. Hey, folks, we're on the air twice a week with shows, and we appreciate you being a part of our network. You can join us and our newsletter and get more feeds and leadership tips by going to successmadetolast.com. And as we always say, be the best version of you. Have a great week. So thanks to our sponsor, Edward Jones. They are our trusted financial advisor. And Edward Jones has been instrumental in helping us pivot our lives built around health, happiness, travel, and adding value to other people's lives. You can contact our advisor, Serban Marasini, by emailing him at serban.marasine@edwardjones.com. And thanks again to their sponsorship of this program.